Thanks, everyone, for coming. We're going to get started. So thank you all very much for coming to hear this this presentation, especially on such a nice, beautiful day. I asked them to have the lecture moved outside, but there was no good venue for it. That's on such an awesome afternoon. I hope you're all having a wonderful reunion. I know I am. And I'm very honored to be speaking to all of you. My class asked me to do this, and I've been an active member of my class, coming back for things. I actually did give a talk 5 years ago on computer vision, which is my area. This is not an update to that talk. A lot has happened since. You don't need to have seen that talk to understand this one. But I have been in artificial intelligence my entire career, starting at Amherst College, and now it's a commonplace term. How many people here have not heard the term artificial intelligence before? Great. How many of you have heard the term computer vision before? So if you've heard computer vision, raise your hand. Interesting. So normally, if I ask that question, which I often do in these lectures, 5 years ago, if I'd asked that question, I expect that maybe 10% of the people in a given audience, even a technical audience, might have heard of computer vision. But that's actually been my field. It's a subfield of artificial intelligence that is now very commonplace. It's actually been on your cell phones for about 10 years before the current craze of investment and attention. But it was not working as well, and now things have we've had some breakthroughs, and now there's artificial intelligence in daily life, in some places that are obvious, in some places that we don't know at all. So today I'm going to cover a little bit about how I ended up here in an AI career, and some quick overview of what AI is doing these days, and then some dire predictions about the future. Okay. All right, so a little more audience polling here. How many of you are majors in computer science at Amherst or elsewhere? Any computer science majors? Don't be shy. One, okay. All the way in the back. CS major? Okay, great. Keep your hands up. How many, that's not part of the show. All right, so how many computer science or math majors? Math majors? Good, okay, great. Super, that's almost close enough. I was actually a hybrid major back when I graduated in 89. We had no computer science degree at Amherst College. We had what was called mathematics in computer science. So that's actually what it says on my diploma. I was also the first honors thesis complete student, I guess, at Amherst College in computer science. The McGew professors, Kathy and Lyle, had come to the college just a year or two earlier and revamped the computer science program. And so I was a great beneficiary of their teaching. Okay, so I'll come back to my background in a little bit and some other things. But first, in addition to the audience polling, I'm going to start with a quiz. Okay. Three pictures. Okay, on the left, who believes this picture is real? A couple people. Okay, good. The middle, who believes that picture is real? And by real, I mean modified, not modified, but taken with a camera and so on. And on the right, who believes that picture is real? Okay, a few more people. So most people think the middle picture is real, a few on the left, and maybe a couple more on the right. That's the answer. So this represents a recent breakthrough in artificial intelligence. The images on the left and on the right were generated entirely by computer. The one on the left is actually a morphing of Nicolas Cage onto someone else's face. This is popularly done with Nicolas Cage for some reason. The one on the right is a human that doesn't exist. That person is just dreamed up by the computer and then rendered in this image that you see. And the one in the middle is just a normal image with a slightly unusual viewpoint. This wasn't possible until, say, the past year, to automatically generate very realistic images of people's faces and other scenes as well. Wholesale, people that don't exist, scenes that don't exist, other things that don't exist, is new. There's a technique called generative adversarial networks that's used to do this that was founded in about 2015, and it's been taking off. So I'll talk a little bit more about this later. We're going to do another one, a little harder. Okay, all the way on the left. Who thinks the image is real? Okay, second from left, who's real? Lots of people, good. The child there, third, real. Okay, a few people. And the one on the right, is it real? Okay. You did what most audiences do. You got them all wrong. Okay. Really impressive results are coming out of these systems here. So how does this work? It works by learning data from thousands and thousands of human faces and what they look like, and that's stored in a neural network. And then that neural network is used, it's generally seeded with some kind of a random vector to generate a new novel face that's different than any other face it was trained upon. Now, it is, in some sense, a combination of other faces, but it is, in fact, a true and novel face, those two fake ones there. Okay, so there's lots of reasons to be afraid of this technology. We can invent people, we can take people out of context and drop their faces into other situations. Now, this has been possible with things like Adobe Photoshop. Photo manipulation has been around for a long time, but it took a lot of manual effort and a lot of expertise to create images that were very realistic, but were somehow modified or manipulated. Now we can do this automatically. That means we can do it at scale. We can do it in ways and in huge volumes that have been unanticipated. This has all come around very quickly in the last year or two. So this is really an actual threat to national security in some ways, and the government is actually throwing a fair amount of money at this problem. Okay, so by the numbers, the AI revolution. Starting in about 2014 or so, AI just took off in the research community. There was a breakthrough called deep learning, which really hit the academic world in about 2010, 2011, first in speech processing, and then in 2012 in image, computer vision, image processing. And then by 2014, in the research community that I live in, which is the computer vision world, deep learning had taken over the world. So virtually every paper by 2015 was talking about deep learning. And this is because it worked much, much better than other things. We had been making steady progress in computer vision on hard problems. There had been other breakthroughs. We'd had some seminal works and seminal papers at previous points. But deep learning was this radical advance, and it has just continued to accelerate. Every problem for which deep learning is applied in computer vision, it's beaten the previous benchmarks. We had, a dozen or so main areas in computer vision. Deep learning has advanced the state of the art significantly in virtually in every single one of those, to some degrees more than others. But it has made what we thought was a decade or more out practical today. Computer vision works much better today because of deep learning. If we hadn't had that breakthrough, then we would probably not be talking about it right now. It would still be useful in some areas, in some constrained situations, but it wouldn't be as ubiquitous as it is today. So this conference chart here on the left, these are acronyms for research conferences. CBPR here is my conference, so to speak. It's the core conference in the computer vision world that happens every year, and it's represented by this little blue blob down here. This is zero, and this is 10,000 attendees at the conference per year. And last CBPR, we had 6,000 attendees. If we go back to 2009 or so, we had about 1,000 attendees. It's been skyrocketing. I organized this conference in 2017. The previous year, we had 3,500 attendees. The year I ran it, 2017, we had 5,000 attendees. Okay. Now, granted, I put it in Hawaii. Had an effect, but the next year it was in Salt Lake City and it had 6,000 attendees, so, and you can't blame me for that location, but it has been growing like crazy. And the other ones too. There's also an interesting pattern here, of course. Back here, what is this? This was the first big explosion of artificial intelligence. Back in the mid-80s, neural nets came along and other technologies like expert systems, and they showed some really promising results. This was back when I was at Amherst. I'm an 89, so I was here, 85 to 89. There was this big interest in AI, academically and commercially, tons of investment capital, and there were 10,000 people going to these two AI conferences, the Association of Advancement for AI. Maybe I can sneak in there. There we go, good. Yeah, there we go. Now look at this one. So this one here, these two conferences were back in 1985 at 10,000 attendees, and then they shrunk radically to drop to just a few thousand attendees after a couple of years. What happened? Well, there was overhype, overpromise. So people thought that AI was going to be this great thing. It had shown really good results in academic papers in the labs, and then the bottom fell out. Okay, there was a lot of stuff that didn't work nearly as well as it was supposed to. A lot of people lost a ton of investment dollars, and interest in AI plummeted. We call this the AI winter, because funding followed this. Right? Suddenly, it was very difficult to get research funding for AI instead of other things like graphics and so on, which are doing really well. But we haven't seen, of course, anything like this enormous trend up on the right there. And who knows? Is it going to continue? When's it going to stop? I mean, we wonder about this when we predict forward in our conferences. Are we going to have 12,000 people in a couple of years? It's possible. There's a huge amount of corporate involvement now and a ton of money coming in that wasn't there before. Okay, so other numbers to look at. Startups developing AI systems. Venture capital is flooding into AI. There's so much venture capital going into AI that there are startup companies, at least 10 or 12 that I know of, that only do data labeling for AI. They actually have efficient, good ways to prepare training data for AI. They don't do AI themselves. They hire people to draw little boxes on images around things. That's what we need for training. And there's a whole niche industry, 10 to 12 different startups, and they've all come up in the last couple of years. It's an enormous ecosystem now. Share of jobs requiring AI skills down here. This is Canada, actually, this purple line. This is the US and the UK. Share of jobs requiring AI skills just in the US. This is about a 4.5 times multiplier from 2013 to now. It's a huge, huge number. It's very difficult to hire an AI. I'm hiring a lot of people. My group has grown, again, because of this AI craze. My group has grown about 50% over the last 2 or 3 years, and it's very difficult to recruit AI people with experience, a PhD in AI from a good school. It's incredible, the recruiting pressure, how much salary people can get. Okay, so we'll come back to this in a little bit, but first, my background. So how did I get here? I was at Amherst, did my Bachelor of Arts in Mathematics and Computer Science, a mouthful. And I went directly to graduate school at Illinois. I enrolled in the PhD program there. I stayed for a master's, but then transferred over to the University of Pennsylvania and did my PhD there. And back in those days, these are the kinds of images we were working on and the kind of techniques we were using. So the images were relatively simple. We were using edge detection a lot down there in the lower left, finding straight lines in images. Things were relatively primitive, but it was the state of the art in its day. I also worked for Lockheed Martin in this time period in the 1990s in the division in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, which was near the University of Pennsylvania. And I finished my PhD in 98 and went to GE Research up in Schenectady, New York. I was there for about 9 years and then joined this little company called Kitware that had 30 people, and I started a computer vision group at Kitware to do what I do now. And I've been there ever since for 11 years or so. And as you can see on the bottom here, things progressively got a lot more interesting, a lot more sophisticated, a lot more complicated, which is the general trend. The deep learning revolution hit about here, maybe 4 years ago in the middle of my Kitware years, and has really just changed everything in the way we do it, and has just basically been piling money on us. I will, yes. I'll tell you what deep learning is. But deep learning is really this new thing in AI that has been powering all of this. AI has been around for a long time, as we saw. It's been a lot of different things. Deep learning is neural network-based processing that I'll describe in some detail that has driven these huge number of changes. Oh, I should mention, please ping me with questions. I'm happy to be interrupted and chat. Yep, I'll get to that. Okay. So Kitware, my company, I put this up here just to do a little bit of hype and maybe some recruiting. Kitware is an open source company that has been around for about 20 years. I've been there for 11 years working in computer vision, and we don't have a lot of computer science people here, but you might have used some of our tools like CMake, which we do, and other things, Visualization Toolkit. But we have a lot of work in government. So in my group, it's about 90% government funding. So the stuff I'm going to show you today is largely funded by government agencies like the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, Air Force Research Lab, and places like that. So we've done a lot of different aspects of computer vision over the years. We now have about I have about 50 people in my actual group. We have about 60 people worth of work in computer vision. There's other groups at Kitware too. It's about maybe half of our company now. And we do all these different things. Computer vision, it looks at all kinds of different imagery. So the images you take on your phone are a big one, but there's also images taken from outer space, looking down at the Earth, telescope images looking out, the black hole image that was very popular in the news recently. There's a lot of computer vision and machine learning done to enhance that image and form it. In fact, there was a paper that about that work a couple of years ago at our conference at CBPR. We do a lot with airborne imagery. So you have an airborne UAV, which is an unmanned aerial vehicle, some kind of an aircraft with a camera on it taking pictures far away. We do a lot of processing of that video for the military. It can be very useful to automatically go through that video footage to help discover what's interesting in it. Okay. So at the core of this, as you can see in the middle, is now deep learning. So 5 years ago, that wasn't a deep learning box, but it is now. And I'll tell you what it is, what deep learning means. But it's pervasive in this community. I mean, I've never seen a revolution like this in my years since 1989 in this field. It really is unprecedented, and it's going to continue. We work with a lot of universities. So I'm not an academic, but I'm like an academic. I do a lot of publishing, run conferences and things like that. And this is over the past 3 or 4 years we worked with these schools here. So we have a very good pulse on what the research community is doing and what it's about, mostly in the U.S., but some in Europe as well. And then we get a lot of funding from government agencies. We were able to take software and funding that we developed for one of them and work for the other. So up in the right-hand corner is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration up here. And they're a civilian agency. They worry, in this case, they take a lot of underwater imagery to count fish and determine fish populations. And so we use the stuff we developed for the defense world, and we apply it to the civilian agencies like NOAA as well as the National Institutes of Standards and Technology and other ones. And we work with a lot of different companies. Okay. This is my curriculum on the left from my artificial intelligence course at Amherst College. So back in 1988, 89, the first AI course was offered at Amherst by Professor Roger, who's not here anymore, and Raker, sorry. And this was the course that he had defined for us. And it was a very typical AI course in its day. I went on to graduate school in AI, and there were plenty of things that on this curriculum that were the same. And the interesting thing, going back and looking at this, I hadn't looked at this, obviously, for a few decades, and I dug it out. And don't ask me why I still have these notes in my archives. There's a lot of stuff there that is in the course today. So on the right is a description from the course catalog at Amherst College, it's on the web today, of the artificial intelligence course that's currently being offered here. And there's a little less detail on the right, but it's still talking about the same kinds of things. State-space search, machine learning, noisy sensor readings, and automatic game playing, which I'll mention a little later. So this is often true in research, right? Problems, good problems never die, is a saying that we have. We also have a saying that if you're in a research topic and it becomes difficult to get funding, goes out of favor, just wait 20 years and it'll come back. Which is really true. I mean, there is often a 20-year cycle. And that's what's happened with deep learning. So 20 years ago, this was one of the main parts of our course. It was all about neural nets. So remember, the AI winter happened in the 90s, but in the 80s, there was this big boom of AI. And it was all about neural nets and some expert systems, too. So on the right is a little neural net, and I'll tell you what that means in a minute. But the backpropagation is what you do to train a neural net. That's how it learns, some equations behind that. And today, everyone cares about backpropagation again. In between, from about 1991, 92 or so, up until 2014, hardly anyone cared about neural nets or backpropagation. It was difficult to get papers published. People said it didn't work. And there was really no attention paid to it except for a few core researchers who stuck with it. There was a handful of people at NYU, University of Toronto, a couple other key places, University of Montreal, and they were not quite shunned by the rest of the research community, but it was not too far away from that, right? They had a lot of difficulty getting their papers published, but they were sticking to it. They knew that neural nets were the way to go. It was going to win out in the end. And fortunately, they're all still alive. So often in science, that doesn't happen until after you're dead. That's when people actually fully appreciate what you did, and you died in poverty, and, and you knew you were right. But this time, they're actually still alive to see the fruits of their success, which is great. So Jan LeCun, who's a vision person in this machine learning world, I've known him for decades, back before he was a super famous god of machine learning. And he gave a talk a few years ago, now that he's all famous, and he was like, well, I knew neural nets were the right thing, and now you all know it too. And he was right. So it's really interesting to see this this evolution. And really, the stuff we're using today in neural net processing really is actually, at its core, very similar, in some cases exactly the same, to what we were using in the 1980s. Now, there has been some significant differences, and I'll talk a little bit about what that means and what had happened. So to go into a little more detail about this revolution, it's pervasive. It started in universities. Companies like Google quickly picked it up and supported it. So now there are huge AI research centers in Google, some in Facebook, Amazon, and so on. They all have big AI groups, and they're all pushing forward with this. The government, U.S. government, is pushing forward with tons of funding in this as well. So what happened? Well, there's something called ImageNet. So ImageNet was created back in about 2008, 2009, before deep learning and so on. But it was just another big data set challenge for computer vision. So in computer vision, we have a data set that someone defines. A researcher just can create a problem by defining a set of data and something to solve in that data. For example, you might have a bunch of images like these, and the goal is to come up with a single keyword or phrase that describes the main content of that image. And that's what ImageNet is. ImageNet had defined 1,000 object categories, and in each object category, there were about 1,000 images showing an instance of that category. So you have a lot of variability. One category might have images of the close-ups and far away, the same object in different settings, and so on. And the goal was to take a new image and automatically figure out which of those 1,000 categories it is. So quite simple. So label the image with the right category. And there was some test data defined. Now, in our world, in the machine learning world, you always want to train on different data than you're testing on. It's kind of cheating to test on your training data because you've seen it before. And you might have memorized it and said, hey, this is what I saw before, and it's not really learning anything. So ImageNet, of course, made that separation. And this was before deep learning. It was a good challenge, right? People liked this problem. It was a big problem. So it was a bigger data set than people had made before. It had millions of images in it. It was expensive because you had to find these images and annotate them. But they did that, and it really captured the imagination of the computer vision community. So people were working on this ImageNet problem for years. And as we can see down over here, this is an error rate. So in 2010, the error rate was 28%. That means on the test data, 28% of the time, the computer was going to be wrong about what object it said was in the image. And the other time, it's going to be right. So 28% error, well, that might not be great, might not be bad. Maybe that's not useful for some applications, but it might be okay for some. So people work on algorithms and come up with clever ways to do things. And by 2011, it had gotten to 26%. And people had been working before this on this problem for a few years, and it had been hovering around this little improvements of 1% or 2%. But then this one funny little paper was published, and it was an error rate of 16%. Reducing from 26% to 16% is actually a big deal. That's quite difficult to do, especially in one paper. But what was really remarkable is that paper had a totally different approach than anything else these other papers had done. It was using neural nets. Neural nets. Well, those are things from the 1980s. Those don't work. But here they showed on a real problem that they didn't invent that it actually did much better than everything else. This got people's attention. A lot of people who were never looking at neural nets and had no interest in them suddenly did. They looked at neural nets and they said, wow. And so over the next year or two, people replicated that result. It's very important in science, replicate. And they did, in fact, replicate it and then found ways to improve it. And so this curve right here, this error rate dropping very quickly over the next 2 years, all the way down to 7%. So from 26% error down to 7% error just in a couple of years because of this initial deep learning work and then improvements upon it. And that was fundamental. It was enormous. People suddenly realized that neural nets might actually be doing something really interesting. And then they started applying them to a whole bunch of different problems, and it turned out they did better on those problems too. They do require a lot of training data, a lot more computation than other things, but this was incontrovertible. So the other thing that was going on that enabled this was that there's a lot of data. So back in the 90s and the 80s, when neural nets had been prevalent before, we didn't really have, you know, these. We didn't have that many ways to take digital images. I mean, how many people had a digital camera in 1987? They were expensive, they were rare. We just didn't have very much data. Well, neural nets, they want a lot of data to train on. So we now had a lot of data. So that really helped. A lot of data, this image net problem, so a ton of data. Also, compute power had increased. And computer vision had always suffered from lots of computation required to do things that didn't seem very interesting or compelling or great results. And compute power had continued to increase over the years, so more things became possible. It became possible to process video, which is a whole stack of images in real time, do things efficiently. And then graphical processing units, that's what GPU stands for, had come along and were very powerful, and they worked really well in this problem. So this kind of computation and this kind of data together is really what enabled this. It still took months to get a result, by the way. So that original paper, it actually took 3 months for them to train that algorithm. That's wall clock time. But they did it, right? And they had some GPUs. Yes? I know. We're getting there. Okay. So the last thing that happened was open source software. So in 2012, there was this one result from the University of Toronto. Well, it was really hard to replicate because the model had 65 million parameters. Huge model, very, very complex. And it was, but people did it, and then this one group at Berkeley said, University of California at Berkeley said, well, why don't we make some good, robust software which will be able to do neural nets flexibly, and we'll make it open source for the community. And they did that, and suddenly everybody used it, and that enabled this enormous proliferation of papers. So this part is often overlooked, but I'm a software person, an open source software person, and that really was a huge contribution because it enabled people to build upon this and really have all kinds of new developments and beat those error rates down very, very quickly. So I won't mention that too much. Okay, this is what a neural net is. Okay, this is deep learning. This is the neural net that started it all, that was in this 2012 paper. It's called AlexNet because the first author is named Alex. Okay. From the University of Toronto, Jeffrey Hinton, his advisor, had been a longtime artificial intelligence researcher and had done neural networks in the 90s and continued to do them through the 2000s. He had been publishing in certain areas, but he certainly, I think, had felt the pressure of not doing neural nets for people. Okay, so what is this thing? And I'll show some image results and make it a little more clear. But an image goes in over here, and a label comes out. Okay, that's straightforward. What is an image? Well, an image is a set of pixels. Every pixel is three color values, so red, green, blue values, every pixel. Every pixel gets mapped into this neural structure in this image here. And then that neural structure is processed by what we call convolutional filters. And convolutional filters are well known in image processing. And what made this work is that there were some fixed number of these convolutional filters and that they were learned during training. So we knew about the human visual system. How does it work? Well, it's been studied a lot, and it turns out that the human visual response function for a lot of our sensors inside the eye mimics what's called a Gabor function. I'm not going to get highly technical here, and I didn't want to put it on the slides. But this Gabor function, it turns out, is learned by this network. So you can show that this network up here, it learns these little Gabor filter operators here that the human body actually uses. This is what they look like. Okay, this is a learned functional basis, okay, a convolutional basis that's learned by this network. And it turns out that people had actually created these things by hand for decades, working out the equations and everything, and here they were learned from the data. That was kind of a breakthrough. Yes? Yeah, I will in a minute. Okay. So learning from the data means you throw out a whole bunch of images and you do back propagation on it and you figure out the weights in this network. But I'll come back to that in a minute, okay? Let me describe this first. So during test time, you just take an image and you put it through this network and it runs a whole bunch of these filtering operations on it, okay? And that means taking these filters and applying them to that image. Well, how does that happen? Well, it's not too important to go into those details, but basically, if a piece of the image looks like this, so it has this sort of banded structure to it and so on, then you get a strong response from this filter, right? The filter will say, I'm good here. And if a little piece of the image doesn't look like that, then the filter says, no response. Okay, and that produces an image. It's a filter response image. So every one of these filters, you run it across the image, and you get a filter response. And these filters can be similar to one another, like these two are. They can be a little different. And they're supposed to characterize at a low level what an image looks like. And that actually works, right? And this was known before, except they weren't learned, right? So, and Jan LeCun is the one who created this bit here, I should mention. He's one of the people who created these breakthroughs and gave me these slides. So this is level one. Let's go back. So that's what this first layer in the network looks like. Okay, it looks like that filter basis. So you take these pixels, you put them in there, and you run those filters over them, and you get another image, a whole set of images, and then you do it again. You take those filtered images and you run more filters on them and produce more images. You run those filters on them and you produce more images and more images and more images. And you do that 5 times. So these 5 layers of filtering on these images. So this was layer one filters, and then this is the top patches of images that correspond to those filters. And if you're not following this, don't worry about it. I'll show some stuff later that makes it a little more intuitive, but you can see these are little patches of stuff, like little corners, little lines, little edges. So at the low level of vision, this is what the computer wants to do to an image. It wants to say, all right, I'm going to have some edges over here and some texture over there that looks like this. Maybe there's some round things. Maybe there's some little square corners. That's at the first level. This is the second level. So the second level, we're now actually looking at a bigger part of the image. And we get more sort of textural, larger elements, little pieces of things, little roundish things. At the third level, I'll come back to that. At this next level, you can see the pieces getting bigger. So now we're getting little pieces, maybe the top of someone's head, the patch of an eye, and entire pumpkin faces and things like that. And then at the top level, we get, at the next level, the fourth level, we're getting whole parts, or entire objects if they're not so big. And this is all climbing through those layers of the network. So that fourth level, for example, corresponds to this. And the way that's working is we're taking these filters, we're applying them to the base image, and then filtering on this, producing a filtered image, applying more filters to that filtered image, more filters to that filtered image. Why does this work? Nobody knows. That's the funny part. Why doing a convolutional basis on top of a filtered image should actually produce something that is also meaningful is actually a little unusual. I mean, it's actually quite difficult in a mathematical, theoretical sense to show why this should actually work. And no one yet has really done that. There's not an actual solid theoretical grounding that says why an architecture like this actually should produce a useful result. What is obvious, though, is that when you're up here at this layer, we have what's called a larger receptive field. I'm going to go into this just a little bit. So take this point right here. See how it expands when you go this way? And then this little point here expands when you go that way. And this one expands when you go that way. That means that a point in an image out here covers more than one pixel down here. It covers a whole big patch of this image. And that's called a receptive field for one of these layers. And that's why these things are getting bigger. There we go. Okay, got it. Okay. So these are the filters that it's learning at layer 3. And you can see they correspond to circular shapes and corners and things like that. And that means if there's one of these things that looks like this in the image at that location, this filter is going to say, I'm on. Otherwise, it's going to say, I'm off. Okay. So AlexNet works this way. In the end, you're taking an image in, you're getting a label out. At the very end of the network is this vector of classes, 1,000 classes. Let me go back to that. So all the way at the end over here, we have this thing with 1,000 on it. What that means is there's 1,000 classes that we've trained, and all this is 1,000 little neurons, and you want one of them to light up and say which class it is at the end. So the image goes in, and this 1,000-dimensional vector pops out, and you hope that one of those neurons, one of those elements of that vector is lit and the others are not. And sometimes that happens, but sometimes it's a little fuzzier than that. So in this image right here, there's a leopard that goes in, and it's mostly leopard comes out. That means there was a little point in here for leopard, and it had a value of, say, 0.7. And then jaguar had a value of like 0.2, and cheetah, 0.05. And you can see why it might confuse a leopard and a cheetah and so on, so that seems quite sensible. But there's no indication here that this is a jet aircraft or stop sign or other classes that might be there. So in the end, we have this vector over here, and one of those elements you want to light up corresponding to the class that's in that image. Okay, so that's the goal. So how do we train something like this? Well, training means you start with the network not knowing really anything about leopards and so on. And how we train it is we say, here's an image, and I'm going to tell you it's a leopard. And I want you to take that image and run it forward through my network, and I want that leopard little spot over here, that one element of the 1,000, to light up. If it doesn't, I give you an error. That says, and I'm going to take that error, and I'm going to use that error to say, well, I'm going to try to fix this layer here against that error. So I got that error. I wanted this one little bit to light up. It didn't. So I'm going to change these networks a little bit to try to light up that little beacon for leopard. And I'm going to suppress all the other ones. And then you take another image of a leopard, and you do the same thing. So you know it should be leopard, and so you try to adjust this layer of the network to point to leopard. And then you try to, and then just this layer of the network to point to that one, and this one to that one, and this one to that one, and that's called backpropagation. So you're adjusting these parameters to try to get to the right value here in training, which you know. That's why you need labeled data. So you might have 1,000 images of leopards. So you can run each of those through here, and initially, when the network is initialized, it knows nothing, so it's not going to say leopard. It's going to say almost gibberish. But you do this a bunch of times. That's where the computation comes in. It says, it takes a guess, and it's not leopard. It's jet aircraft or stop sign. You say, nope, it should be leopard, and it moves it a little bit towards leopard. And you do it again, and you do it again, and that's what takes hours and hours of GPU time, because you're not just training on a leopard, you're training on stop signs, jet aircraft, and so on. So in the end, from a parameter space perspective, there's 65 million things that have to be adjusted in this network. 65 million little values that dictate all these little lines going through here. 65 million values have to be learned. And in the end, that's a lot of values, right? Our previous models didn't have that. They had maybe 200 or 300, a few thousand. And the more parameters you have, the more expressive your representation is, the more stuff you can recognize, the more robust you can be. No one had ever had a model with anything like this number of parameters before. Usually we were down, as I mentioned, in 1 or 2,000, and that was it. So this is an enormous model of parameters, but they figured out how to actually train it. There's some tricks there that I won't go into, and make it work. And therefore, it was able to do this 1,000-class problem and actually do it better than anything else. All right, so that was the huge breakthrough in deep learning. This is all based on models of human cognition, as I mentioned, and the human visual system. This was not out of nowhere. This architecture had been explored in the 1980s, a bit in the 90s, things like it. And then it was revamped with new computing power, which allowed us to do that training in just a few months instead of infinity. And it comes up with results like this. So these are those training images. So you might have a bunch of different elephants, a bunch of different types of flowers, aircraft carriers, etc., pumpkins. You want some good variety in your training. And then these are results. So images not used in training, give it an image like this, and it says cherry. The ground truth here is cherry. but it also has this dog, and so it comes up with Dalmatian and a little bit on grape. This one, the ground truth is mushroom, and it comes up with mushroom, but also agaric. I'm not sure if that's a type of mushroom. This one, the ground truth is grill, and it comes up with convertible, and then grill is the second one, which is pretty good. This one is mite, it gets it right. Container ship, it gets it right. Motor scooter, it gets it right, and so on. So in 2016 or so, 2015, for this problem, neural nets beat humans. This is a hard problem. So human performance had been exceeded by algorithms in some other domains too, but not on anything like this, not on anything as close to this difficulty for problems. But the human error rate on this problem is about 5%, and that's because there's errors in the labels, and people don't necessarily know what something is. But so there's inherent error always in these human experiments. Humans aren't perfect. We want to measure what human error rate is. And so in 2015, algorithms beat humans on this problem, which is a monumental result. So some other big AI results that have been enabled by this technology are things like face recognition. So we did, in the 90s, we were operating on a database like the one up in the upper left. And now we're operating on databases like this, where you have lots of changes of expression, and the lighting is different. There are images captured not for face recognition, but images taken from other video that were applied to the recognition problem. And up here on the up here is one of the performance curves. We typically have a graph like this showing our performance, our accuracy. And before, the previous method is this green line down here. The ideal line is a right angle that goes up like this and hits 1.0 over there and then goes straight across the top. That's what you want. So you want a curve that pushes all the way up and to the left. So you can see progressively these curves are getting better. So this is EigenFaces, which was a good state-of-the-art face recognition method in the 1990s, early 2000s, variants on that. And then there's an open source method, and then this Deep Face Ensemble, which is the best performing one, up in here. Right, so dashed line there, and it's right at about human performance again on this very difficult, complex data set in face recognition. Automated image captioning. This wasn't even really possible before deep learning, but one of the neat things that we do in deep learning is to combine computer vision with natural language processing. So computer vision is the study of images. Natural language understanding or processing is the study of text and language by computer. So automatic assessment of what's in a document, summarizing a document, determining, parsing sentences automatically, things like that. So there's always been work on putting vision and language together. But deep learning enabled an enormous advance in this. You can train on images and captions together, and then you give it an image with no caption, and the computer guesses at what the caption is. And that's what's happening here. These captions are all automatically generated. So it just gave it, you gave it the image, and then the computer produced the text describing what's in that image. So this was some pretty seminal work that came out of Stanford and Google kind of simultaneously around 2015 or so. And there's been many advancements since then, extending this to video, so just actions that are happening in different parts of the video, not just static images like this. And you know, really impressive results. Again, this takes a lot of training data where you have images and captions in them, but the system learns the two together in this combined model, which is very, very impressive. There's another problem called visual question answering. It's a little bit of an academic problem, but the idea is that you give an image, like this one, and a question to the computer. And the computer has to return an answer. So in order to do that, the computer has to understand the question. So it has to do some natural language processing and parse that question. How do I know what to look for in the image? This is a person would. And then it has to understand the content of the image. So what are these pixels? Are there humans and faces or objects in here? And so in this case, who is wearing glasses? And the answer is man. That's the correct answer. And here, the correct answer is woman. Where is the child sitting? In the fridge. Maybe it was a hot day. And, you know, in the arms of his mother here. How many children are in the bed? You know, one versus two. Is the umbrella upside down? Yes or no? So this is a challenge that was introduced a few years ago, and people really liked it because you had to put language and vision together, you had to do complex image understanding. And so this is a leaderboard on the right. It means people submitted their algorithms to this problem, and there was a challenge score which ranked them all, and people can do this kind of continuously. So these are the accuracy of these. We're at a, these are percentages correct. So 87% correct is this algorithm here on yes-no questions. Yes-no questions are obviously easier, 50% chance of getting it right. But a number question, like how many children are in the bed, it gets a 51% accuracy. And then other types of questions, like where is the child sitting, the accuracy is 63%. So this is, you know, enormously good progress over the past few years. We use leaderboards like this to measure our progress on the same data set. So keep this problem the same. People submit new algorithms and get better and better all the time. Yes. Yeah, neural nets, there's two parts to that. So so the question was, how much computing power is needed to do all of this? And the answer is divided into training versus testing. So when the neural net is learning, when we're giving it the labeled images, when it's trying to figure out the label assignment, so we say a leopard image, we tell it's a leopard, and it has to adjust its weights, that's the training phase. That's much more computationally expensive than testing. So once your network has learned everything, you give it an image, and it just comes out with the answer. So for the testing phase, typically, for these kinds of problems, and for ImageNet and so on, those kinds of problems, it get back an answer usually in about a tenth of a second on your average size image, maybe half a second, if you have a GPU. Now, a GPU is a graphical processing unit. It has high parallelism in it, typically like 200 GPU cores. If you did that on a CPU, it would probably take about usually 20 to 100 times longer. So if you're like a regular computer, it might take you, say, 10 seconds to get an answer. If you have a GPU in your computer and you use it for this, it might be a tenth of a second. That's for the test time. For training time, typically on this type of problem, here, it's till on the order of, if you have a good GPU, a lot of data, generally you're talking a number of hours. It could be 10 hours to 100 hours. If you're doing a big problem, it might be a few weeks, but that's pretty rare these days. GPUs have gotten faster and faster. There's been a lot of optimizations. In my lab, the longest training runs that we do, I would say probably about 3 days on a single beefy GPU, something in that range. So another problem, autonomous driving. Yes? Compared to an iPhone? Let's see. So iPhones actually do have little GPUs in them often, but it'd probably take your iPhone on a testing time, like a normal algorithm, it isn't really optimized. It might take maybe 5 seconds to do an image on your iPhone. But there are neural nets that run on some iPhones or cell phones now that are optimized for it and do these problems in, you know, half a second or less, particularly for easier problems. Depends on the difficulty of the problem. So one of the main application areas that's really emerged from all of this and is enabled by it is autonomous driving. So autonomous driving is a big area. You know, there's a lot of press about it. About maybe a third to half of the technology development going into autonomous driving from the sensing perspective is computer vision, because most of these systems are camera driven. So it's people are looking at LiDAR and other sensors that I won't explain here, but mostly the autonomous driving systems that are being put out there are using cameras just like our eyes and doing computer vision on those pixels. And this is what it looks like to the computer. So ideally, this is a manual label annotation, but from an image like this, you want the computer to come up with this map right here, which says this is road, these are cars, this is a truck, those are trees, these are traffic lights, very important. So you need to detect all of these objects and see where they are, and you need to do that in real time because you're driving. So you can't wait 5 seconds for your answer. So this community is really pushing on real-time performance. And you could do it in real-time if you had 4 GPUs in your car, but you don't want 4 GPUs in your car. Your car would cost about $15,000 more and would need another battery. So maybe another engine. So these are the problems that this community faces. Right now, a lot of the vehicles have a ton of instrumentation that you can't put into mass production. But companies like Tesla that have these have optimized all of that. they've optimized these networks, they're doing something just like this and producing these maps, and then there's some reasoning about it that goes into the controller. It says, stay on the road, don't hit this other car, it's a pedestrian over here, etc. That's all coming from detection like this, with cameras that are mounted typically behind the mirror or somewhere else in the car, with a little bit of a above ground viewpoint. There's a really cool aspect of this, learning to play video games. This may sound like a computer scientist's dream, but people really actually work on this, and they get paid to do research here. But there's an area called reinforcement learning, which is generally learning control. So an algorithm that's controlling a car, for example, it needs to decide, am I going to turn left or right, accelerate, decelerate, etc. That's called control. And you can learn control using deep learning. So there was reinforcement learning before this, but deep reinforcement learning is using deep learning techniques for reinforcement learning. And it turns out, like everything else, that it works actually quite a bit better than other things. So there's actually some really cool work. I'm going to click on this and see if that works. This is risky here. I'll see if it pops up here. And, Oh, yeah. Let me... It's playing for me. It's a really cool video. I'll see if I can drag this over there. Okay. Good. Okay. So what's it doing? So this is a video game, Super Mario Brothers. You may know it. A computer can learn to play a video game in a couple different ways. So one, we can actually just give it these pixels. We can give it pixels of the video screen, like a computer vision problem, and say... and then it has a controller, so it's just like a person with all the controls a person has for a given video game, and then the computer figures out whether to jump or run or hop or do other things. And it also gets feedback from the video game, like you died or you got a reward, and that reward function is used in a learning process. So when the computer starts out, it knows nothing about the video game. It just has a character there, and so it just has to pick a move. So it tries a move. Maybe it moves to the right. And then it sees what happens, and it moves to the left and sees what happens. And so it has to figure out to move and how to get rewards. And to do this efficiently is very very key, because there's tons of ways you can do moves, and it would take forever to learn. You could just jump up and down and get little rewards and never move and progress through the game and get a much bigger reward because you don't even know about it. So you have to put curiosity into these systems. They have to actually explore the space automatically, which is pretty cool. So there's computational curiosity methods, and some are better than others, and people get papers based on having a better curiosity method. So this is a really neat area that deep learning has also really pushed forward on. The same type of deep learning control is going into autonomous cars. So again, we've trained them with lots of data of driving, and things you should do, things you shouldn't do, and it can actually control cars. I hope not. So I think your Tesla, the cars have the highest level of automation of production vehicles. I don't think they're using deep reinforcement learning in their production models, but in a few years I would expect that they might have those coming out. I mentioned, the problem with reinforcement learning is like video games are used because you need those experiences where you die, right? I try this, my reward function was death. So you can see the problem. Okay. So back to fake images. How many of you have heard of deep fakes? Most of you. Good. Okay. Deep fakes popped out a year or two ago from, again, deep learning, and this was a particularly impactful computer vision paper, because this was, just to rehash for people, this is a impersonator of Obama. So in this case, he was saying and acting like Obama, saying a particular speech, and then the computer automatically morphed Obama's face to say the words that this person was saying. Okay. So he literally put words in Obama's mouth in a very, very realistic way. And this is a real Obama, and this is the fake Obama, just a couple of frames here. And this was very, very alarming, because you literally have a video that looks not quite realistic, but pretty good, of the President of the United States saying stuff that he never said. And that's totally frightening, right? Because this is potentially could be done for anybody. And in principle, you need a lot of images, again, of Obama to do this, but it's certainly a big threat. And so Marco Rubio, the senator, said this when he saw that video. And so there's a lot of concern in our government, and there's funding to try to detect this. Right now, we're actually really good at detecting that this is a fake video. So automatically, we can still detect these fakes quite accurately. We as in computers, and particularly computers in my group. So one of the problems we work on is detecting image forgeries, whether they were made by other computers or by people. This is an image from North Korea. Any North Koreans in the audience? Okay, good. South Koreans? Okay. So pretty much everything that comes out of North Korea in visual media, images and video, has been doctored in some way. Basically everything. And they do this for various reasons. In this case, they wanted to give the impression that they had a lot more military equipment than they did. And a simple way to do that is to just copy-paste. Right? So you have, say, one of these things, one of these amphibious landing craft, and you just take the pixels here and you cut them out and you plunk them over there. Voila, I have two. And it didn't cost me much on my budget. And same thing over here. Right? Here they're claiming they have seven of these things. So a human can look at this, and humans did the analysis here to say that this is likely to be the same. Because here this pattern in the mist and the wake and the spray here is exactly the same as this, and so that looks really unrealistic. And I didn't want to put up the National Geographic fiasco, but how many have heard about the scandal with National Geographic and the starlight photos? Anyone? Okay. National Geographic is known for its photography, right? And it was just discovered in their recent issue that that this whole big photo spread of beautiful starry night skies over these trees in different parts of Africa, virtually all the images were manipulated and faked. They took some parts of the Milky Way and copied them over here again just to make these very dramatic skyscapes. And so National Geographic is reeling from this because their reputation is now very tarnished in legitimacy of their photography. Yeah, it's really horrible. So we want to be able to automatically detect these things. So, and this is a big problem. How many of you have seen this problem before, this image in particular? Okay. So after the Parkland shooting in Florida, there was a video put up by one of the students here tearing apart this target and saying, "We are not targets. I am not a target." And someone from the right, right-wing side of the political spectrum in the gun lobby created this so that she's tearing apart the Constitution. And they just pasted the Constitution in there quite a realistic way. And then this went out. And the people who saw the image on the right first thought, "Oh my God, you know, this is, you know, my Second Amendment rights," and so on and so on. So it's very inflammatory. So the question is, could we detect this automatically? Could we automatically find that without having the image on the left, could we just take that image on the right and realize that this part was manipulated? There was something fishy about it. And the answer is sometimes. So another little guessing game. Okay. Yell out parts of this image that you think might have been manipulated or inserted by someone using, say, Photoshop or some other manipulation technique. Go with the sign. Okay. Shadows are bad. Hiker. Good. These are all good things. Okay. Gotten pretty much everything now. Right? Okay. Okay. All right. All right, so the sign, and most people miss the rock, this rock right here. They actually did a pretty good job of putting in the rock. It's actually the same rock, it's just expanded and rotated a little bit. Okay, this is the result of our algorithm to detect manipulation. So it runs on images, it doesn't know anything specific about this image, but this is a real result from the algorithm developed in my lab to do this stuff, and it picked out the goat, the rock, and a little bit on the sign, probably missed a lot of the sign. So we're actually able to do this. This is a deep learning algorithm that we trained on manipulated images and not manipulated images to try to differentiate the two. And it's actually better than human performance. It's actually hard for humans to see this kind of stuff. But really what it's picking out in this case is not the shadows. There are subtle little statistics about the pixels that can be different from one image to another. And so when you take an image of a goat from one other image and you paste it into this image, those little statistics about noise in the image and texture and so on that are really imperceptible to a human can actually be picked up by the algorithm pretty robustly. So this is the way it works. I won't go into it, but we're using what's called a residual image and some filtering and image processing stuff and deep learning on top of that. There's the one equation I put in my presentation. So here are some results from this. The image we just saw, where the ground truth is this right here in the detection algorithm, green means it's getting it right, and red and blue means it's making little errors. So down over here, this is a funny little square. It's kind of a poor manipulation, and it manages to pick that out. Some other ones, you know, this sign was replaced or inserted. This is kind of a facetious example, polar bear on the beach. But a lot of people miss the umbrella and so on. This is a tough one. The boat was added, the birds. So humans are really actually quite bad at this, but the algorithms can be better. No, we haven't tried the admission scandal images. Yeah, so the photo, they manipulated the images. We have a lot of examples in the news all the time, and we do run those through our systems pretty regularly. Okay, so, and then sometimes we miss things too. So there's some accuracy there. So to wrap up with some broader perspective questions here, AI has gotten pretty scary. Like any technology, it can be used for good or for evil, and there's a lot of people who will certainly use it for evil and already are. So what can we do? The answer is not stop doing research in AI, because even if the U.S. did that, our other countries will not do that. The competitive advantage of AI in commercial world won't allow that, so it's really not a viable option, I think. But one of the things that scares people is something like this, where every part of this was automatically generated. It's completely fake. It's a website called This Rental Does Not Exist. There's also another one called This Face Does Not Exist. And all those faces we saw can be from there. So this is a completely generated image of a bedroom that doesn't exist. So again, the computer, it was trained on images of bedrooms, and then it automatically generated one that was similar to what it had been trained on, but it is unique and different. Even the words are automatically generated. It's in French and then in English. And there are little artifacts in there that, like there's a toilet that you will access to the bedroom and bathroom. Not quite a sensible sentence, but it's not too bad. So this is getting better and better and better. So you could have Airbnb sort of infiltrated with these sorts of things, right? And people go to a rental and something bad happens. So the other problem that we face a lot in this world is armed autonomy. So what happens when somebody puts weaponry in various levels on systems that aren't properly regulated or controlled? I'm not personally worried about the U.S. doing this. We have a lot of controls. We have a lot of autonomy now in our armaments, and they're generally very, very carefully regulated. And I'm sure we'll continue to do that. The question is what our adversary is going to do. And so there's been a movement around trying to get ethical computation into systems. So this is a pretty cool experiment done at MIT. You can see the webpage there, and this study went on for years, where they asked people, what should the autonomous vehicle do when it only has bad choices? It's going to kill one person or another. What should it do? Right. So it has sudden brake failure. It's either going to kill this person here, or these two. Or sometimes it's the person or the driver inside. Sometimes it's a baby versus an elderly person, and so on. So this really captured people's imagination, and tens of millions of people took this survey and filled it out, and they got these really interesting results. For example, in Asian countries, people chose to kill young people to preserve the elderly. And the opposite is true in Western countries. So this is a really neat experiment talking about how we can explore these ethical issues around, say, a self-driving vehicle. This is a terrifying video, I won't play it, called Slaughterbots, about a very realistic near-term future use of UAVs to do essentially a mass attack on people, where UAVs would be equipped to recognize and target a certain person, and a little UAV has a charge in it, goes in and shoots you in the head. Oh, sorry, unmanned aerial vehicle, so a drone, right? So a little drone like that are common everywhere. And this is a very realistic video that was made to scare people. It's very scary. So I recommend watching it. Stuart Russell at Berkeley has been an advocate in this area, and he created that video. So this effort by Stuart Russell creating that video resulted in an open letter to the United Nations signed by over 3,000 scientists and engineers saying we need regulation on autonomy and AI and controls that should be put into place by all these governments. It's a noble effort. I think it needs to be done. The problem is, you know, are governments like North Korea and so on going to adhere to that? Even if they sign off on it, will they actually do it? Probably not. And what defenses would we take against armed autonomy and fakes online that are intended to disrupt? So right now we're looking at a big program in disinformation to try to combat this because we're worried about the Russian interference in the upcoming election. And they can do it with automatically generated videos and all kinds of other things, and we are really unprepared as a country. So I did a study recently for DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, on this topic, where we're looking at how we actually would encode ethical reasoning in an autonomous system that had to decide in real time and make very difficult decisions, often where there's no good option, right? This person will die versus that one. What are the technical challenges inherent in such a problem? And it is a very difficult problem. Even humans don't know what they would do, but we want computers to be able to reason around those ethical subtleties and make these moral judgments in a way that a human would at least understand and respect. And right now, that's beyond the state of the art. Okay, so the message I would leave you with, don't trust what you see anymore. Verify it, check your sources. Don't believe anything in National Geographic, for example. That used to be verifiable. And privacy is a big issue. I haven't really touched on it, but the way that the Obama impersonation and things work is because there's a lot of images of Obama out there. If there aren't a lot of images of you out there, it doesn't really work. So if you have a lot of images of yourself out there online, you're much more vulnerable to these kinds of attacks. And finally, we need to have open debate about these AI issues where people talk rationally and don't get all caught up in the hype about creating the Terminator, which is moderately possible. The U.S. isn't going to do it, but what if Iran does? So we need to be prepared for that and take appropriate moral and regulatory steps to keep AI in check. All right. Yes, Tim. Yes. Mm-hmm. Full task of driving yesterday. Yeah, autonomous vehicles right now, I'm only being slightly facetious. So in good weather, autonomous driving is better than humans. It's safer than humans. That's been proven. So autonomous vehicles have driven tens of millions of miles. We're probably over 30 or 40 million miles across all the different experimentation that's been going on. And the number of accidents in there and fatal accidents is a tiny, tiny fraction of humans driving those tens of millions of miles. So they're already provably much safer. The catch is you have to live in California, maybe Arizona. Yeah. But as soon as you put them in bad weather and at night in the snow, then performance is well below human. So one way to rephrase your question is, when would that happen for all weather? And that's hard. I mean, driving, if you've driven on Interstate 90 in the wintertime and upstate New York where I live in a blizzard, the snow is careening across the road, you can barely see, is an autonomous system going to do better there? Right now, it wouldn't at all. But I would say in the next 10 years or so, maybe less, we will have that. Yes?
So you asked what majors people were entering, just focused on computer science and mathematics.
I did, yeah. Yeah, I think it's a great question. So I mentioned briefly that I put together this this study for the government on ethical AI. And we had great representation from philosophers and lawyers and technologists, machine learning people like me, and then representatives from different domains, autonomous driving and the military. And we had maybe 40 or 50 people in this invited workshop at Berkeley. This is just back in April. And the dialogue was pretty incredible because we had all these different disciplines involved. But the philosophers were there, and so they were talking about these sorts of things. You know, they're the ones who really dive into these issues and understand them. They don't have the computational side, but some of them get into it a little bit. So I think you need the philosophers in the room, and we need to have the computer scientists in the room and bring them together, and as well as the lawyers. Very important to have the legal framework and have sensible legal academics. In this case, we had some professors from Berkeley and Northwestern and others in academic law who are focused on technology policy, because that's evolving very rapidly. Technology always evolves faster than the law around it, right? And the law has to catch up. How big is that time lag is always the question. Yeah, and the question is, what are the military applications of this for autonomous vehicles in particular? In the near term, the way the military is using autonomy now in vehicles is actually for logistics and convoys. So you could picture a convoy of 50 military vehicles. You've probably seen these going down the highway sometimes. You could have a driver, a human driver, in the front vehicle, and then all the other vehicles just have to follow it. So it's actually an easier problem, and they don't have to get anywhere very fast. So they're actually doing that now. Autonomy, a fully autonomous system in combat is a long, long way off. It has to think about a lot of different things and understand a lot of different things. The main area where that's being developed is actually in fighter aircraft. So fully autonomous dogfighting, because if you get the pilot out of an autonomous, out of an aircraft, you can be much more maneuverable. But you have to have the pilot in there to know what maneuvers to do right now. And so there's some big programs on autonomous combat aircraft. And when the first one is really fielded on that, it will destroy all the other ones. So those are some of the areas. I mean, we don't work in those particularly in my group, but the military is looking at a lot of these things. But again, I think on the U.S. side, we are very, very careful about how we regulate these things. And I personally don't really worry about what we're going to do with them in terms of allowing the Terminator. All the way in the back. Yeah, that's a great question. So generally, mammalian vision systems are pretty similar to one another. Cephalopods are studied quite a bit. These are squids, cuttlefish, things like that. They have great vision. So a squid has no blind spot, for example. They have the best visual systems in the animal kingdom. But they are very similar. So most higher order animals that have vision systems do have the rods and cones and things like that that are similar to the way the human visual system works. Insects are a different animal, though, literally, and they have a very bifurcated vision system. Some people have taken inspiration from the insect systems. They have these very complicated lensing. They don't have the normal single optical lens that we do. They have a whole bunch of refractive little elements, and it's a very different type of perception. There's not a lot of work on emulating insect vision, but people have looked at mammalian vision, and it is quite similar. Well, last question, second. Yeah.
So, obviously, as you're approaching some of these systems to detect whether something has changed, there's a risk that people then use that and improve the faking.
Yes.
Yeah,
so the question is a good one, because if we get an algorithm to detect the manipulation, then you can maybe make an algorithm to overcome that while doing the manipulation. We're quite worried about that. And the main answer is that there's a lot of different algorithms to detect manipulation in different ways. I mentioned there's these little pixel-level statistics that we were doing, but there's also shadows and physical plausibility and things like that. And so a good defense is to have a wide range of these algorithms that are operating at a bunch of different levels. Then the deception would have to overcome all of those, which is actually very difficult. Yes.
Already subject to image manipulation. They've already been fulfilled.
Yes.
Yeah. Does
that screw up your ability to detect things? It can. So if you're depending on pixel level sysics and then someone resizes the image, right, you just shrink it a little bit, or you actually just recode it. Images are usually in a JPEG format. You can compress them a little more. It's called double JPEG. That can actually destroy some of these signatures. So the way we handle that is we train on those kinds of distortions and then see if we can still detect the manipulation. And performance degrades, but often that signature is still there. The other answer is to not use the physical level techniques, but to look at the digital level ones, but look at physical ones, because reshaping the image or resizing it, recoding it won't change that the shadow is wrong or that the lighting is wrong. So in the end, that physical layer of assessment might be the one that wins out. Because typically when you upload an image to a social media site, it recodes it, right? They want everything to be very consistent in the encoding. So regardless of what format you had it in, what size it was, you know, Facebook will put on the standard bank of Facebook filters so that they can keep everything consistent in their archives. Yes.
Flight paths are so carefully regulated.
Yep.
And because many stormy landings are controlled by the glass cockpit anyway.
Yep.
Why do you need airline pilots, or when do you think they would be replaced?
Right. I think we don't need airline pilots. Nowadays, I think it's kind of a well-known secret that they often make things worse rather than better, except on that, you know, MAX plane. Which is a good lesson, right? a lot of interesting lessons for Boeing in that. But I think the automation in the airline industry is very, very high because it's much easier. So it's much easier to fly a plane, actually, than it is to drive a car, as it turns out. You wouldn't think so because pilots are so highly trained and all that, but that's why airplanes are so automated, is because the whole airspace, the whole system around it is completely regulated. The plane's going to go from here to there. It just has to go and take off like this. And then the control system in the air to keep it there is really much simpler than driving through a parking lot. So the level of automation is very high. It's really a societal question, right? Would we want a plane with no pilots in it? How would we feel about that? And it's just like a driverless car. Do you want a car with no driver in it? You want somebody who's got his back to the windshield and is, you know, on his phone, and is that okay? Like,
you've read a few articles about China and China's investment in AI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, quite a bit. We talk about that a lot in our community, in the research community, and in the defense community even more. So a couple things to say. So first, China has, for those who are not necessarily following this carefully, China has created the most complete example of the Orwellian state that has ever existed at this point. They've instrumented a particular city with video surveillance cameras, thousands of them everywhere, and they're doing facial recognition and biometric recognition of all the people in all the videos all the time. And this is a Western city in China. I forgot the name of it, but it's it has a significant population of a minority, the Uyghurs, I think, that have been repressed for centuries in China. And so now they're using the surveillance as another very effective method of suppression. And in China, you know, if it gets it wrong a lot of the time and they arrest the wrong people or accuse them of something, it doesn't matter. Right? In the U.S., you would get sued, there would be accountability, but over there, it's just not the same. So the other aspect of China that's very scary is that we have a lot of privacy laws. The European Union just really upped their privacy laws recently. Again, they don't have that in China. right? The government can grab everything. That's why, you know, the U.S. is so worried about Huawei and other companies just sending all their data to the Chinese government, sending all of our data to the Chinese government, and we use their stuff. And it's a huge problem. So China will get ahead in certain ways where these enable things, right? We are in government funding. I don't work for the government directly, but I work on government funding. And we have a lot of rules about what data we can't use. And it really prevents us from doing research. You might want to do research, for example, in detecting child pornography. But you have to have training data for that. Well, it's illegal to have child pornography. And how do you get around that? It's a big problem. And we even if you do, do your employees, are they okay seeing it? Do they feel coerced in their jobs if they have to look at it? I mean, these are real problems that we have that the Chinese say, forget it, doesn't matter, do it. So it's just, you know, we do hamstring ourselves in Europe as well. And that will hold us back. Will it hold us back to the point where we're really losing? I don't know. I mean, I don't have a chart here. I thought about putting it in. But people compare the number of submissions or accepted papers in our conferences from their country of origin. So from the institutional country of origin. So the U.S. institutions. Now, of course, the U.S. is, in my area, it's about the grad students in the U.S. are about 70% Chinese. But if you ignore that and you just say U.S. institutions submitting to these conferences versus Chinese institutions submitting, the U.S. is still generally a lot higher in some of these, but not in others. You know, China actually had more submissions this year, fewer acceptances than the U.S., but it's almost on par from Chinese universities. So they've really pumped a bunch of money into their universities and improved their quality. I mean, Tsinghua and other ones have always been very good, but usually their best undergraduates came to the U.S. for graduate school, and now they're being pressured to stay in China. Yes? That's right. Go ahead. Yep.
In the context of reinforcement learning.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And but everything we're talking about is like a highly supervised framework where it's very clear what you're learning and it's very clear what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
Even if you're exploring like this mm-hmm. space. And it seems to me that you're talking about like real intelligence, you're also deciding what to learn.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there's a ton of it. That's called unsupervised learning. So supervised is when you have the labels I mentioned. This image is a leopard, and you tell the neural network to learn leopards. You can also skip that, and you can just give it a bunch of images and tell the network to cluster them, to put similar images together that look doesn't know what they are, just knows that these images are similar to one another. And then the network will actually learn the same types of representations that we saw in doing that operation. And that's called unsupervised learning. So there's a lot of work in that. I didn't really want to mention it at all, but there's a ton of great work in unsupervised learning across a variety of domains, not just imagery, but also text and social media and all kinds of things. Probably not quite as big as supervised learning, but it's very substantial. Yes, you. I don't know. That's a very good question. I was a little curious about that, too. Canada does tend to be pretty technologically progressive.
It's changed from baseline 2013, so that might just say more about their baseline in 2013.
Yeah, very much. It could, yeah. I think it's a really good question. I think in the U.S., let's say, it will be determined by the lawyers and the insurance companies. So how do you insure such a vehicle, right, in this circumstance? It's got to get sorted out in the courts. That's going to take a while. It's an interesting and challenging problem. When you go international, there's no problem actually just swapping in one network for another, or one learning system. So if you needed to have a module for Chinese driving versus U.S. driving, you would do that. You actually need to do that anyway because the roads are different. Like if you're driving in England, you don't want the U.S. module.
to make it more problematic, instead of looking at across different countries, mm-hmm. even within just say the U.S. culture,
mm-hmm.
we know we have many different, you know, demographics with very different ethical norms.
Yeah.
People can have very different, strong arguments on different sides of ethical issues.
Right.
What decisions the artificial intelligence should be making.
True. Right now, if we think about not computational intelligence and then ethical decisions, and did you make the right decision, the right choice amongst a set of bad ones, and there was some legal implication, it's literally sorted out in the courts, right? So legal ethics is the way that works. I suspect that'll be the way it works here. Someone can program a vehicle, it'll make this choice, you'll get sued. If they win, you'll change your program. Oh yeah, certainly. Yeah. Just like Boeing. Change their software. Yes. Okay, thank you.